Hello, and welcome back to the Video Essay Podcast. I'm your host, Will DeGravio. As you will know if you listened to the two previous episodes, the podcast turned 3 years old this summer. I want to again thank all of you who have listened to the show, appeared on the program, and assisted in some way in its growth. I am, again, so grateful for all of you in this community of practice, of people who are invested in this kind of work. To celebrate, I've been curating clips from each episode of the podcast to give you a sense of all the different types of conversations that have happened on the show over the years. This week, I have gathered the final collection of clips from episodes 21 to 31. Gathering this audio also serves as preparation for a talk that I will be giving later this week at Theory and Practice of the Video Essay, an international conference on videographic criticism at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The central question of the talk is this: what can be learned by aggregating more than 30 podcast interviews with creators into a portrait or portraits of the video essayist? As I mentioned, the following clips are, in part, my answer to that conversation. So, here we go. In 2020, the podcast collaborated with Charlotte Crofts, director of the Cary Comes Home Festival, on The Journeys of Cary Grant, an audiovisual celebration. We invited video essayists to submit videographic work, or really any kind of remix video, on Cary Grant, centered broadly on the theme of journeys. In fact, this year, 2022, we are partnering on another call for video essays for the upcoming Cary Comes Home Festival. We are seeking video essays on Cary Grant pertaining to the theme of class. Select works will screen at the digital festival, and creators will be invited to participate in a live event during the festivities. For more information, visit thevideoessay.com or check out the link in the description of this podcast. But in this clip from 2020, Kendall Kruver, who runs the popular blog Watching Classic Movies, describes how creating her first video essay as part of this program changed the way she viewed a film she had watched repeatedly since childhood, Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious. The other voice you hear is that of Charlotte Crofts.
Well, when Dr. Crofts sent the invitation, I almost discounted it completely because I'd never done a video essay before and I had no idea how. As often happens with technical matters, I just asked my nine-year-old how to do it. And the reason why was that I immediately had an idea of what to do because Notorious is my favorite Cary Grant performance. And I actually, in my mind, saw it as a journey and his personal journey. And it's just that interesting way of Hitchcock, the MacGuffin, where you've got all this tension over all these different plot points, but it's really about a different kind of journey. And I think that Cary Grant so rarely had a deeply emotional in his films. So much of what he's done has been lighter and comedy, romance, that sort of a thing. And he was clearly a little nervous about going deeper, but here he definitely does. And he shows you what he could have done if he had taken on more challenging, you know, emotionally challenging roles.
Can I ask you, a bit like Philip and Roberto were saying, like, because you said you've not made a video essay before, was there something in the process of actually playing with the clips on the timeline which elicited new knowledge that you perhaps wouldn't have got just from writing about it?
Definitely. And it made me realize
that it was something I needed, that I needed to engage with film criticism and exploration of film in a visual manner. And if I'm not creating the films myself, then the next best thing is to dive into the creation of another and really look at the details. I feel turned on to the process of video essays now. Like, it's something I want to do because it will help me to experience these films. I mean, how many times have I seen Notorious? I've been watching it since I was a teenager, but I feel almost entirely differently about this film. It's much deeper to me now. So yeah, it was a revelation.
The next episode featured a conversation about the 2020 Sight and Sound poll of the year's best video essays, and also a short conversation with Kevin B. Lee about a master's program he was building at the school he now formerly used to work at, Merz Academy in Stuttgart. In this clip, Kevin talks about his push for the exploratory mode of video essay making.
Yeah, it gets back to the classic kind of dichotomy of, you know, video essays as being exploratory or explanatory, you know. Like, I think we've touched on that in the past. And yeah, I'm team exploratory without a doubt. And I think there's something very powerful about being able to enact an experience, an experiential, you know, media practice where your audience is, they feel like they're discovering it almost in real time along with you. There's something, you know, I think there's something very powerful, like, you know, you used the word humanistic earlier, and I definitely believe in that, like, especially in an age of, you know, kind of like artificial intelligence and algorithms kind of dominating our lives in so many ways. And, you know, and being confined to like media interfaces and Zoom screens and so much technical filtering, like how do we rediscover human experience, human connections? And how do we make video essays reconnect to that humanness, which is, I feel, is very precious right now. Yeah, and I connect it to also to, you know, there's this term called experience design, which is also very important to me. I mean, traditionally, it's a new media concept. It's meant to describe like user interfaces or VR experiences. But I think that experience design can be applied more broadly to, yeah, if to everyday life, like, you know, to see yourself as having the agency. And certainly like Facebook and YouTube definitely promote like, oh yeah, you are now the content creator of your own life, you know? So, okay, if that's the case, then how do you approach that with a critical design methodology or ideology in mind? Like, you know, how do you take responsible, conscientious, and critical approaches towards designing the media experiences and artistic research experiences that you then present for others to experience? So, so it is about thinking about what kind of experiences you want to share and how do you share them.
Episode 23 of the podcast featured you, the listeners. More specifically, in 2020, listeners of the podcast made the videographic exercises designed for the Scholarship in Sound and Image workshop at Middlebury College. In this clip, Gemma Saunders reflects on the process of creating the exercises.
My name's Gemma Saunders, and I'm an audiovisual PhD student at the University of Birmingham in the UK, where I also work. I've made a few short video essays before 2020, which had mainly been multi-screen compositions. So when the video essay podcast started saying homework exercises, this was a great prompt for me to explore some new areas of videographic criticism, as this ties into my PhD as well. And I tried to link everything I did into my research area through the text that I chose to work with, and my research area is the representation of Birmingham on screen. I rewatched all 5 of the films I made before recording this, and it's interesting actually to reflect on the particular challenges each one posed, as well as the things that I was actually really pleased with. I'd started to make a Petra Kutcher, for example, before hearing the podcast episode, but it was the call out that actually made me finish it and put it on Vimeo. And personally, I think this is my weakest of the 5 exercises, and it's definitely one I want to try again soon with a different media object. It's hard to pinpoint exactly why I feel this way, but unlike some of the other pieces I made, the Petra Kutcher doesn't feel as if I gained many new perspectives through making it, and I didn't feel that it had a tangible underlying argument, which isn't necessarily essential, but it is different to how I felt about the others. The reason I chose the film Take Me High, apart from the fact that it's set in Birmingham, and you should watch it if you haven't seen it, it's really surreal, is precisely because it is a film. A lot of my videographic work focuses on contemporary TV, which means the volume of material can quickly get very unwieldy, so having a contained film made selecting 60 seconds of audio much easier. And this ties quite neatly into part of my answer to the question, what did you learn from the process of creating one or more of the videographic exercises, which is that setting boundaries can be super helpful. And it would actually be a key piece of advice I'd give too, that a parametric approach, particularly when you're starting out, makes these exercises much more manageable, in my opinion. And sometimes this is through necessity. So with my epigraph, for instance, I used the opening sequence of Ready Player One because this was the only part of the film that I could actually access at the time, but it can also really help to focus your argument. So with the multi-screen I made specifically for the podcast, I thought, okay, I've done a few of these before, how can I come up with something new relatively quickly? And I decided that I would just experiment with using footage from the first episodes of 2 shows, Peaky Blinders and Man Like Mabeen, which again, both set in Birmingham. And I think this one actually ended up being my favourite of the 5, because from a research perspective, it prompted me to think about several new angles to explore after I'd made it, such as how Tommy and Mabeen engage with their urban environments and their different senses of home. Voiceover was a tough one for me. I'd resisted it entirely up to that point, and me recording this now is actually another prompt for myself to try and overcome the fear of speaking into a machine, but I was really glad that I did it. The simplicity of the instructions again really helped with focus, and I feel now that I can use that performative element of this technique to create argumentation in different ways. I have been saying ever since that I need to do another one, so maybe that's a goal for the next month or two. And likewise, going back to the epigraph, this was one of my first experiments in integrating critical material with a media object in a kind of creative way, and it's really opened my eyes to new ways that I can use this technique going forward as well. And that one I made, I think that was at the height of lockdown one, and it was all about escaping reality through film, so it seemed quite resonant at the time. So I guess that brings me to the abstract trailer, which was by far the biggest challenge, but again, challenge is good, and it was a really useful exercise in the context of my PhD because it forced me to think about how best I could summarise what it is that I'm trying to do. I went through several drafts and I almost gave up at one point, but after feedback from a couple of friends who also make video essays, I was able to recut something that I was fairly pleased with in the end. Still not 100% happy, but fairly pleased. And that would be my other top tip. Even though it can be daunting, don't be scared to ask people for comments on your work in progress and on finished pieces too, because it's both a creative and a critical process, and it can be hard to kind of accept that criticism at times, but getting constructive feedback and other points of view can be invaluable.
The episode also featured a conversation with the creators of Learning on Screen's video essay guide, Estrella Sendra and Bart Maletti. In this clip, Estrella discusses her motivations for launching the guide, which is one of the most invaluable tools out there for those interested in creating and teaching this kind of work.
Even though we are always talking about the value of film when it comes to writing about film, we tend to go back to the most conventional way of writing, which is through the written word. So I was very kind of like enthusiastic to try something different and to draw my own personal experience as a filmmaker and as someone who had been trying to find an academic space for different videos that I had been making for my PhD and failing to actually have them counted for, or there were difficulties on replacing this with words and so on. And I was kind of keen of testing this and saying, okay, let's make it optional. And instead of this typical class presentation, which is a PowerPoint, let's also give them the option of an audiovisual essay. So last year at SOAS, I implemented this both in a master's class and in an introductory film class. I was teaching both for the very first time, and I was the one who designed these two classes. And the experience was great. Students were so enthusiastic about this method, but they were also very worried or stressed about it. And I found that that was a shame because the result was so great that I was like, okay, how can we avoid this kind of issue in the future? Because it was also then, I mean, as a teacher as well, you find yourself reflecting about your pedagogic methods. And I was engaging with bell hooks' work on transgressive education and Paulo Freire's work as well on education as the practice for freedom and as a problem-solving system where students are not digesting information and then just vomiting it in exams, but rather they become co-curators along with the teachers of the content. I was thinking, okay, so how can I make this still a creative assessment, but to offer some guidance? Because at the end of the day, when I started teaching as well, I didn't offer that much guidance on how to structure essays, and I found that I needed to in the end. And sometimes it was in feedback once the grades had been released, but some other times it was also just kind of some guidance in the assessment. So I said, okay, for next year, I'm going to put together a guide to avoid what bell hooks call these painful experiences. Painful experience in the learning process where students feel very vulnerable, right? And for many different reasons. So try to make university a more inclusive place as well. But this requires me as well to acknowledge that maybe I didn't do good enough and I should have been offering some more guidance. And I was just reflecting about this, and I was walking with Bart and his partner in the park. She's one of my best friends. And I was asking him a few questions that came up about copyright. And then suddenly, I don't know if it was her or him who were like, hey, listen, I don't think you should be doing this just for your students. This is a common issue, because I was also kind of saying, I've been following this website and Catherine Grant's work and all this pioneering work from the grassroots being done on video essays, but I couldn't find anywhere like a guidance of a step-by-step on how to go about this if it's the first time, right? Especially from a student perspective or an early career researcher, creative researcher. And they were like, I don't think you should be doing this for SOAS only. And Bard said, oh, we are actually putting together guides along with playlists. And I think this could make a really strong case for a guide because it just aligns with our mission so much.
Episode 24 of the podcast featured conversations with Douglas Pye and John Gibbs. In this clip, John discusses creating his video, Have You Seen the Carioca?, and his blending of various types of media in the piece in his use of a mind map.
So yes, it was absolutely an intention to use as many different media as I could in the form of the video, and that's obviously in the spirit of examining these different media, but also deliberately deploying different approaches in the form of the video. So that was certainly part of my intent, and indeed helps you to make some of these nonlinear connections as you move from one practice or media form or art form to another. It was also the case that I was very keen to bring out the research journey, as it were, or bring out some of the process. So that mind map or concept map is exactly the map that I was, you know, page of a journal that I was working away on and making those links, and that's the real thing. And also I wanted to bring some of the sort of journey of finding out things and make that part of the spectator's experience of the video essay as well, if you see what I mean. So I wanted it to have a self-reflexive quality in that respect and to draw attention to some of the limits and some of the successes of the process of research or the process of creating scholarship. So that was absolutely part of my hope as well. What was the final part of your question there, Will? Oh, yeah. It was about whether we make a hermetically sealed kind of approach, whether as audiovisual essayists we're trying too hard to create something that's really smooth and moves us very dynamically through the material. I was very happy to have a more open form in that sense. But let's not forget that being self-reflexive and, well, A, there are lots of very interesting practices in contemporary videographic criticism, which are precisely about being self-reflexive and drawing attention to the means and the process. And if you think of some of the traditions of desktop documentary, or you think of Kevin B. Lee's work where he takes the timeline of the editing program and uses that as an analytical tool. That's as much videographic criticism, I think, as creating a really effective cut or dissolve that makes your point. That's just as much deploying videographic and audiovisual means to make your point. So I think there's absolutely that tradition. But then also being self-reflexive and, you know, involvement and distance are not mutually exclusive. And I think that maybe that's true about how we work as audiovisual essayists too. We might say that of an O'Fools film or a Brechtian performance, but it's also the case, you know, not claiming my work's in that category, but, you know, you can move between different kinds of address in interesting ways. And actually being aware of your own process and the form in which you're working, I think makes a lot of sense for a video essayist.
And here is Doug, who collaborates often with John on video essays, offering his view on the necessity of language for criticism. What does this mean for the video essay?
But it seems to me, you know, if one's talking about videographic criticism as opposed to any other thing that you might think that videographic work can do, but it does seem to me that you're involved in argument. You know, you made the point earlier on. I mean, and argument, you can develop, to some extent, it seems to me, an argument via images and, you know, and the sound from movies alone. I've seen some work, I couldn't name it, but, you know, that clearly attempts to do that. But I think ultimately argument without language is extraordinarily difficult. I mean, I know, you know, language itself, of course, has phenomenal difficulties with movies, you know. I mean, and that's partly what makes Victor's work so extraordinary, that Victor's work at its best, and it's at its best a great deal of the time, is adequate in a way that very few writers' work is to the movies that he talks about. You know, I mean, it's he finds ways through language of describing, evoking, and analyzing in ways that just will feel to many, to most probably viewers, true to the film. That's not true of an awful lot of work that we see. But anyway, language. So how do you conduct an argument completely divorced from language? Great thing about videographic criticism at one level is simply that it can make certain kinds of certain uses of language that you need for written criticism, for print criticism, redundant. You know, you don't have to do levels of description that you might have to do. On the other hand, you know, I'm thinking about some stuff that I've written, but also stuff that Victor's written. You show a sequence, for instance. I mean, John and I show the opening sequence of Notorious, and well, I think we show it two or three times. We keep coming back to it, but we show it, and then we make some points about it. You know, it's point out things about it. Now, we haven't had to describe it in elaborate detail through language, but you do have to then say, okay, what do you find significant about this? The way in which the camera moves, the nature of what you see, why all the blokes are wearing hats. Those things don't necessarily leap out and draw attention to themselves, although they're there. You know, we all see the same movie, but we don't all take note of the same things. And indeed, it's incredibly difficult to take note of huge masses of the material that a movie, you know, constantly presenting you with. So, I mean, it's simply that at one level, you know, how do you do that kind of thing without language? How do you conduct an argument without language? So it's a sort of, I'm a skeptic of non-language based criticism. Mm-hmm. I don't say it doesn't exist, but I'm not convinced that I've seen it yet. I've seen a lot of work that is very evocative in the juxtapositions that it makes, and the, you know, the wonderful ways in which you can kind of overlap images, and I mean, extraordinary things that you can do. Very evocative, very thought-provoking. Whether I would consider them arguments, critical arguments, well, perhaps I'll just say I'm not sure.
After episode 24, I launched On Your Screen, a companion show to the Video Essay podcast, dedicated to various aspects of digital moving image culture. Because that show is separate, it will not be included here, but I just wanted to give a quick shout out to it. Scholar Terry Francis joined for episode 25 of the Video Essay podcast to discuss her book, Josephine Baker's Cinematic Prisms. During our conversation, Terry discussed the crucial role that the Scholarship in Sound and Image workshop played in helping her think through the completion of her book.
It taught me that I was not done with Josephine Baker and there was more that I needed to learn. And it taught me to pay attention. It showed me just the limits of what I had been doing and that there was a whole other archive in the movie itself that I had not even remotely considered. It was so humbling. It's kind of embarrassing to admit, honestly.
You know, I think a lot of people, like including Catherine Grant, have talked about this intimacy that you get with the film object when you make videographic criticism. It sounds like you felt that. Terry's nodding right now. What was it specifically that you saw? I don't know if it was like one thing, but what was it that for you triggered that insight? Or maybe it was a series of insights and a series of things. But take us into it a little. What was that? If you can remember, I mean, it was 2 years ago at this point. But
no.
Yeah.
I remember. I remember that shit. It was the Pechacucha. Pechacucha? Yeah. It was the, I don't know if it's six pieces of 10 seconds or 10 6 second.
10 6 second, yeah.
Yeah, 10 6 seconds. And I was looking for my 6 seconds. And that's when I noticed, like, but this love interest of hers is never looking at her. I was like, what's going on here? And I noticed that her friend is often in the sequence and he's got a hand on her hip and he's looking away. And Josephine Baker's character is just talking on. And she thinks he's listening, bless her heart. And he's not at all. He's completely disconnected. So, and he's the spotlight. he's the spotlight that should be making her sparkle, and yet he's turned away and she's over here. So once I noticed that, I said, oh my God, this is what I sensed, but did not know to, because you know, you're thinking narratologically, you're right. Thinking of the big narrative story. And when it comes to this type of a romance plot, you don't think it's important. It feels like a side note, but this assignment and video camp in general helps me to recognize that as knowledge and as a source of future knowledge about Baker. And so that first Petra Kucha, I just grabbed these moments where of this non-touching and non-looking, and that she's often in a frame by herself as well, weeping, locked out. There's one when she's in the rain knocking on the door and stuff, and it was like, oh my God. But by contrast, he's touching the hair of the other girl and just, you know, always, you know, scooching up to her and stuff, and just seeing it. I hadn't noticed it that plain, just on a visual level. I was really overly caught up in the words and the narrative and the ideology of the
right.
And I realized, oh, it's not about that. It's just really visceral, earthy, grounded. He don't want her.
Episode 26 of the Video Essay Podcast featured a conversation with Allison Dufresne and Tracy Cox Stanton, who joined to discuss an issue of The Cinephiles they co-edited, dedicated to the scholarly video essay. In this clip, Tracy discusses what makes a video essay scholarly.
Themes that reverberated through the whole issue, I think. As many people pointed to In Transition, the publication In Transition, because it's the one that claims that these are scholarly, right? It's the one that's kind of part of the deal. And, you know, I thought it's interesting that Christian Keithley, you know, in his essay that accompanies the videos in the Once Upon a Screen section, you know, as he says there, that sometimes even the editors of In Transition don't agree on what constitutes scholarly. So I think, or what constitutes a scholarly video essay, you know, so I think that there's also then the question before that is what constitutes the scholarly, what is scholarly, right? And even that's difficult. Even that's not as clear, but then the scholarly video essay maybe gets more unclear. But, you know, I think every, you know, the key themes that come up for the scholarly are argument, but not just argument, but argument that engages other scholars' ideas. You know, the real definition of scholarly, that, you know, colloquially, I guess, if there's such a thing as colloquially with anything related to scholarship, is that it cites sources. You know, so a publication like The New Yorker, you know, might have an essay about the French New Wave. And you read the essay, and I remember reading an essay in The New Yorker about the French New Wave and thinking like, oh, well, that was so-and-so's idea, and that was so-and-so's idea. You know, I recognize because coming from a university and studying, you know, you recognize where the sources are, but none of them are cited, you know, and that's okay because it's not a scholarly source, right? So I think we get away with a lot of that in video essays too. And it's difficult, you know, that's one of the themes that comes up in many of the pieces is how it's kind of difficult to cite sources in the video essay. You know, you have to sort of wrestle with that and figure out, I mean, what's most exciting is trying to figure out how to leverage the audiovisual potentials of the video essay in a way that does those things that are scholarly. You know, so nobody wants the video essay to be, you know, someone reading a scholarly paper and showing film clips that illustrate that. Right. You know, so in no way is that what I think anybody is advocating for. So right. that's where the magic comes in. You know, that's where the fun comes in of everybody trying to figure out how, you know, how is there a way of using these tools that are not new tools? They're only new to us, right? So as right. Allison said, you know, these filmmakers have been using montage for a long, long time, you know, but suddenly now we can, you know, and so how do we then sort of harness those things to what we've already been doing in our scholarly investigations?
And here is Allison.
As part of this issue, our sort of primary stipulation was that contributors put stakes in the ground and that they define what they mean by scholarly, because we may all have different ideas of what the scholarly is. And it's partly why this issue took so long to come out. Many, many contributions had to go back with requests for greater clarity. And, you know, there were a few people who they, you know, just didn't, that wasn't what they were interested in. And that's what we're interested in the issue. And what I have found is that when people talk about scholarly, what Tracy is saying, you know, is true. Like there is this very narrow definition of the scholarly, which is, and I say this actually in the essay that I wrote for the issue, you know, I asked my undergraduates, what is a scholarly analysis? You know, what have you learned? And what they'll say is it's a analysis that is making an original contribution to a larger conversation through a contestable statement, thesis, argument that's demonstrated through audiovisual, often through audiovisual analysis and research. But often when people talk about the scholarly in relation to video essays, because video essays do expand the way that knowledge is produced. I mean, a more vague definition of the scholarly is it makes an original contribution of, you know, it's a form of knowledge production. But people, I think when people talk about video essays and they're talking about scholarship, they're often talking about not just knowledge production, but what In Transition calls knowledge effects. So In Transition has a very broad definition of what's scholarly, and they err on the side of expansiveness and experimentation. And so people will talk about a scholarly video essay, and when you begin to trace down what they're talking about, they're actually talking about the fact that it's critical or that it produces some sort of effective response that is incredibly meaningful. And that's not necessarily the narrow definition of scholarly. And yet there's this sense that one is learning something, one is experiencing, seeing anew and experiencing something. And that's absolutely legitimate. That can lead to a scholarly output. But we were trying to get at some of these distinctions, because an essay in The New Yorker can be critical as well. A work of art can be critical. A film can be critical. That isn't scholarship per se. And yet, as we start to talk about video essays, we often talk about those kinds of things as though they're scholarship.
Episode 20 featured a conversation with Ian Garwood, who has created many videos reflecting on the form of videographic criticism itself. In this clip, he discusses the role of the voiceover in audiovisual criticism.
One of the drivers behind the voiceover video definitely was for me to reflect back on the voiceover I delivered for the Hoagy Carmichael video, which kind of, I think everyone, no one, I don't think, likes the sound of their voice. But I certainly felt there was room for improvement in terms of the way I kind of delivered the voiceover and the way I scripted things as well. So yeah, really that video, there was a lot of the impetus for it was being self-critical and trying to work out how to do it better in the future, or to find other ways of doing this kind of research in this format, potentially without using voiceover. So it was a way of kind of trying to work out what the position and value of voiceover was in the field, looking at lots of different examples, but partly so I could think about what I would do with kind of voiceover in the future. And actually what I decided to do with voiceover was not to use it very much at all in future work. So it was almost as if I'd stymied myself in some way by kind of making this very self-conscious video about voiceover and you know, thinking quite carefully about the value of using it, the limits of using it. I kind of talked myself out of using it myself until quite recently.
Episode 28 featured a conversation with the popular YouTuber Broey Deschanel. In this clip, Maia discusses how YouTube censorship and the algorithm shapes how she thinks about creating on the platform.
I mean, when I first started on YouTube, there was this huge kind of discourse about censorship of queer content. And I've noticed that, like, in my own videos, like, I don't make videos specifically that are about, like, queer theory or anything like that. But there are a couple of videos where I've kind of focused on that. Like I did one on Killing Eve and I named it Queering Eve. And someone in the comments was like, you should be careful using that word in a title because that's like algorithm poison. I keep using that term. So that's like incredibly harmful, especially to the queer community. And then I don't know, like I've seen like some like people I know posting videos and they'll censor the word abuse in the video. And it's like, I think the problem with the algorithm is like black boxing. Like we have no idea what the rules of the algorithm are. So people are just guessing at this point. Like there's no list of words telling you what not to say. And like there are huge YouTubers out there who like swear in their videos, who make sex jokes, and they're not penalized. But then I feel like I'm penalized every time I, you know, whatever, do anything. Like my ads are limited on almost every video. And I, not almost every video, but a lot of videos. And I think that it's just because we have no way of knowing and because it's so random, it feels even more kind of restrictive in that way.
I think I have 70 YouTube subscribers, so I wouldn't say that I'm a YouTube influencer. So when you get to someone at your level where you have a large audience, does YouTube reach out? Or do you have conversations with people there as trying to, I mean, because it's not your job to fix this, but I'm wondering, is it your sense that YouTube takes proactive steps to try to make this better? And I guess my question is, have you seen it improve over time? And do you have faith that it will improve?
I mean, not to be absolutely so negative, but I honestly think it's getting worse. Like I just had in my most recent video, a news segment copyrighted and I had to take the video down and repost it. Like not, it was unlisted, but I had to repost it again without the segment. I've had girls who, like I was talking to one of my fellow creators and she said that music videos, just the visuals of a music video will be copyrighted now. And a lot of the time when you appeal the copyright claim, they can just take down your whole channel. Like they can take a really disproportionate measure against you to scare you out of actually appealing anything. So I think I'm a little worried that it's getting worse, but I will say that YouTube does have a really good system, like a chat system. So whenever I've run into some serious problems with videos, like I'll go to it's like a creator chat. Once you kind of reach the creator, whatever, milestone, you can kind of access this and you can talk to like an actual person one-on-one. And I found it's like pretty helpful. They can't really help you with like major things, but I do think that it's nice that they have that in place. It's kind of like the least they could do, but they do have that.
Another popular YouTuber, Thomas Flight, joined the show for episode 29. In this clip, Thomas talks about his publishing timeline and workflow. How, I asked him, does he know when to publish videos and how often to publish them?
When I was starting out, I was doing a video about a video once a month because I was doing other things on the side. But also it was just kind of like once a month and when I had an idea that I felt like was worth doing. And then once I got into the space where it was like, okay, this is my full-time job. I'm having to take this a little bit more seriously because it's starting to like pay the bills. I settled into a little bit more of a set schedule. And that was basically just based on like scaling up the amount of work I was doing. I was like, well, I can do one of these a month if I'm working at like a part-time job on top of what I'm already doing. So if I'm doing just that, I can do two a month is a reasonable space to be in. So that's kind of where I set it. And then I've stuck to that more or less as a schedule. And my thought, to be honest, at that point was more about what is sustainable for me rather than thinking about what my audience wanted. I'm definitely in a space now where there's upsides and downsides to that, maintaining that kind of schedule. There's a sense in which like the work as a whole is a practice. And there have been times where it's just been really valuable for me to be like, I'm just going to put something out every 2 weeks. And like, you know, I don't get stuck stewing in sort of an idea, forever, just like, you know, waiting. You know, there's times where I find that practice of just being like, make something and publish it really beneficial. But then there are other times where I'm like, I don't have the time to like focus on an idea as long as I would want to. And so I am kind of right now in a transitional mode where I'm moving more towards a space of like giving myself a little bit more flexibility and time between videos so that I can just focus on publishing something really when I feel like I have something worthwhile, or just giving myself a little bit of wiggle room in between.
Episode 30 of the Video Essay Podcast featured a conversation with scholar Jordan Schoenig, who discusses bringing scholarship to YouTube.
So a majority of the videos I have on the channel were actually videos I made for classes that I've taught. So they were used in the classroom in some capacity, many of which were made for that year in which I was teaching online. So I quite literally made a lot of them for undergraduate students who are taking either intro film or film theory or, say, a gender and sexuality in cinema course or a cinema in the digital age course, right? You know, each of those classes in a way have slightly different audiences, you know, if you're talking about the importance of audience. So yes, I teach intro film very differently from how I teach film theory, because the audiences are incredibly different. And that's something I think about all the time as a teacher, whereas, you know, you are, you know, you're performing for this group, for this abstract mass of students, but it's amazing how diverse the preparation and interest is across even, say, a group of 20 who are all film majors. So I think about that constantly. But for the videos that I have made, say, on the channel that were not things that I made for class, I make them as if I am making them for undergraduate students. But I have had some people say email me. I've had like one like adult learner. I forget how I knew that this person was like, you know, an adult learner, not enrolled in college, but just said, you know what, I just like learning about this stuff. And could you tell me what that clip of that movie is in your jump cut video? And I was like, yeah, sure. So I have seen stuff like that. My sense is that most people watching the videos are probably undergraduate students. Some high school, if they're getting, say, difficult theory in high school, like my sense is I've learned recently that I think people learn Laura Mulvey in high school. I certainly, yeah, I'm almost fairly certain that it does happen. It didn't happen for me, but it seems to be people who are interested in understanding the material, probably that it was assigned in class setting, with a small fraction of people who seem to be interested in learning and are okay with this lecture format, which is, of course, not the dominant edutainment format of YouTube.
In what I hope will become a semi-regular feature on the Video Essay Podcast, Ariel Avisar joined to discuss a single project. In this case, it was his TV Dictionary project, which is one of the most significant communal videographic endeavors of recent years. In this clip, Ariel shares the origin story of TV Dictionary.
I do some translating work on the side, translating from Hebrew to English. And I was just watching, catching up a bit late. That was, it was last summer. I was catching up on the fourth season of Fargo that week. And then when I was sitting and working on this book I'm translating, I look up, you know, in the thesaurus to try to find a better way to phrase stuff, and somehow ended up on the word precarious, which was just uttered by one of the characters in an episode of Fargo that week that I just seen the day before. And I don't know, something clicked. Yeah. I was just thinking, and then I went to look at the various dictionary definitions of the word precarious, and I thought, huh, that's pretty much Fargo, isn't it? This could be something. So then I thought I'd go simple because I have a lot of other projects going on. So I just looked at the first sequence of the pilot episode of Fargo and made a little epigraph. And it's the first video in the collection. And I think it's probably one of the least interesting ones because it's very basic. It's kind of like a proof of concept. There's nothing surprising or particularly creative about it, but it made me start looking up other words and trying to match them up with series. And I thought this could be an interesting format to play around with. As a scholar, I'm mostly interested in television studies, and that's a field that's lagging way behind film in videographic criticism in particular. We can talk about that later. So I thought this could be a good opportunity to try to develop some videographic TV related work. And I made a couple more videos, and then I thought, let's invite other people to join, see if it clicks with anyone else. And it did. It was a very productive summer. There was a period of about a month where new entries would arrive like once a day, at least, sometimes a few more. I would go out for a couple times. I went out on a camping trip for a a couple of days and came back home to find 10 new entries waiting for me, which was in the inbox, which was great. As you said, we're up to almost 50 now, and they're still coming, dripping in once in a while. The premise is very simple. You need to pick a television series, any television series, and try to find a word that captures, kind of distills the something of the essence of the show, and make a video. It doesn't have to be an epigraph, though up until now they're all epigraphs. Theoretically, they don't have to be. But the premise is you take one or several clips from the series and the dictionary definitions of the word and try to do something with put them into dialogue as a short video.
And then finally, we come to the most recent episode of the Video Essay Podcast. As I have mentioned before, this three-part episode is made in part as preparation for a talk I will be giving later this week at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The person heading up that effort is the film scholar Barbara Zecchi, so it is fitting that this celebration ends with a clip from my conversation with Barbara, who joined me and Emily Subin Coe, the show's associate producer, for episode 31. In this clip, Barbara talks about her recent video, Feeling the Archival Void, the Case for Helena Cortesina's Flor de España, and the potentials of videographic criticism to fill voids in other archives. To end our celebration, here is Barbara.
I wanted to show my personal involvement with this lost film, and the desktop documentary approach allowed me to show kind of the reconstruction process, the archaeological work of putting together its pieces, even though some of these pieces are false pieces. So I think it's like the work of an archaeologist when they uncovered the artifacts, they cleaned them, they labeled them, they classified them. I felt that the desktop approach was showing that. And I'm thinking, you know, when I was doing this video, I was thinking a memory of my childhood when I went to Greece to see the Knossos Palace of Crete. And it's where there are these frescoes of people leaping over bulls. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's when you go there, you see like a puzzle of many missing pieces that have been reconstructed. So what survives of the original frescoes amounts to no more than a few square inches. All the rest of the frescoes is more or less a reconstruction that was commissioned in the first half of the 20th century. So the original pieces, if I well remember, are thicker, so you can tell the difference. What is original, very little, and then what is fake, and it's thinner, it's just painted. And this is the debate with archaeological sites, right? Whether should the site be reconstructed as we believe it was, or should the site be left as it is for visitors with no clue of the site to understand what it means. And so this is more or less what I meant to do with this video essay, a reconstruction of the original from a few pieces that we have found. Those tears of joy that you see in my eyes are real. You know, when I reconstructed this film, I felt completely emotional. So I thought I have to visualize this emotion. It's important to include it. And so there is a lot about my personal feelings. Also because, as I said before, I really feel the anger and the pain of women's work being attributed to men. And so actually the initial idea with this video essay was to denounce the expropriation. But, you know, this is something that I've already done in my written pieces about Cortesina. So I thought I've done enough of denouncing and deconstructing. So let's now construct something. And so there is still a first part of the video that I did not didn't make it to my final cut of the video essay that's entitled The Lies of the Archives, and maybe I will I will expand it and make another video or a continuation of the first part of this video. But then I ended up just doing filling the void, or rather feeling the void. And this again, you know, it's making fun at myself as a native speaker of Italian, because it's really very hard for me to tell the difference between filling and feeling. You know, an Italian speaker does not distinguish between E and E. It sound the same. It's very hard for me to tell the difference and to pronounce it. I never know if I say to my students, please take a sheet of paper or take a sheet of paper. So feeling and filling the void is the same. I'm feeling and filling the void.